This week's Sound Off is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/solomonster. Over 100,000 titles to choose from, including wrestling titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or other device. Help support the show? Go to audibletrial.com/solomonster and sign up for your free trial right now. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 309 of the Solomonster Sounds Off. It is Sunday, January 12th, 2014. I am the Solomonster. Big week for WWE. Some might look back on this week as the week that changed everything. I guess in due time we'll find out. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about TNA as well. They crowned the new Undisputed Champion this past Thursday. Apparently TNA's definition of the word undisputed is very different than mine and yours. So we'll get into that. First, one last quick plug here, because we have a little bit of time left for voting in the Stitcher Awards. I want to thank everybody, by the way, who's been voting for the show under Best Sports Commentary. I appreciate your votes. And if you are listening to this show earlier in the week, as in Sunday or Monday, you can still vote. Voting ends on Monday the 13th. I don't know exactly what hour, but if you are listening to this show and you haven't yet voted, or if you want to vote one more day, you can vote once a day. Go to stitcher.promotw.com. You will see the Sound Off logo under Best Sports Commentary. Again, we're up against some pretty stiff competition. But please do cast your vote if you haven't done so already. I believe the winners are not announced until later in the month, around the 30th or so. So we're in the home stretch here, and just wanted to remind people, if you haven't voted yet, please do go ahead and vote. Also, PayPal shout-outs. We got a few of them this week. Mitch Lavin, Mitchell Montgomery, Anthony McGregor, Colin Kerr, and Chuck Lentz. They are big, big supporters of the show and really go above and beyond in some cases for the Sound Off. And I want them to get credit for that here and just know that I appreciate them greatly for it. So thank you to the people who donated. You can make PayPal donations to the Sound Off on thesolomonster.com. The box is always there. Give what you can when you can. And just know that I appreciate that. So, the big news. WWE Network formally announced this was the worst-kept secret, I think, in all of wrestling, maybe of all time. If you remember, pretty much all the details that were leaked last month that I shared with you here on the Sound Off were true. The WWE Network will not be a traditional cable channel. It'll be an internet service. That is not their first choice, no matter how much they try to convince you that, oh, we saw the future and the future is online. Yeah. Well, now they do. Now they see that. But for how long were they trying to sell this thing to different providers? For years. For years they tried. And then you have Vince McMahon in the LA Times saying that they had a deal on the table for 20 cents per subscriber and he vetoed it. And that may well be true. I mean, there's no way to know for sure. But the point is, it was not their first choice. They decided to just take everything, keep control over all their content, which is smart. You know, for them, it actually makes sense. I think it's a good move on their part. Because they do control everything. They don't have to share the pie with anybody, not with cable providers, not with pay-per-view carriers. They pay whatever expenses they have, and they keep the rest for themselves. You know, they control the content. They control the delivery of that content. That means it's all on them. You know, they're partnering with MLB Media, which is one of the things I mentioned last month. That's great for them. That's a great partnership. Lots of people who subscribe to MLB.tv rave about the service and the stability of the streams. And that's important, because if WWE has another disaster with WrestleMania this year, like they did with their iPay-per-view stream last year, based on what some of you guys told me, I was actually at Mania. I don't, you know, I didn't watch it on the internet, but from everything I read and everything I saw, didn't go so well. And they can ill afford to have something like that happen again, especially if they're offering WrestleMania on their network. This is all on them this time. And the network officially launches right after Raw on Monday, February 24th, 11.05 p.m. when Raw goes off the air. There will be a live post-show. I believe it's half an hour. I believe the pre- and post-shows on the network are going to be half an hour every week for Raw and for SmackDown. So if you are one of these people who thinks 3 hours of Raw every Monday night just isn't enough, well, you're in luck. Get ready for 3.5-hour Raws every Monday night. I like the idea of the pre and post shows. Again, I pitched that on the Sound Off years ago for pay-per-views at least, and they've started to do that. I mean, going back to WrestleMania last year, I believe was the first time they did a pre-game show. I remember I looked up on the big Titantron, and there was Jim Ross and Dusty Rhodes with headsets on, and I thought, huh, that's pretty cool. And naturally, I think that was the only one they ever had Jim Ross do, which still boggles my mind. So I like that concept, and I'm glad they started doing it. I mean, obviously, it's all kayfabed and everything, but I like that. So I'm not against this idea of doing the pre and post shows. If people want to watch them, that's fine. So February 24th is the start date, and they're not even accepting orders for network subscriptions until that morning. 9 a.m. is when you can sign up and apply and subscribe for the new WWE Network. So what this means is they better damn well be able to handle all of that traffic without any crashes, because you're not even allowing people to sign up until the 24th, and then you're announcing a very specific time. You're saying when Raw goes off the air, let's say that week they have 4.5 million people watching Raw, and maybe they will. They had 4.5 million people watch old school Raw this past Monday, which was the best number they've done since the summer. And that Raw is the night after the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. A lot of those post-pay-per-view Raws tend to do higher numbers. So let's be generous and say that Raw does 4.5 million viewers that night. Now, you're not going to get all 4.5 million signing up for the network. If they did, Vince McMahon would be doing naked backflips on I-95 in Connecticut. Okay, that's not going to happen. But let's say you get a decent number of people who immediately go to WWE.com and try to sign up. All I'm saying is they better be ready. They cannot afford for this to be their version of the Obamacare website. So here are the important points that you need to know. I mentioned the launch date already. The price to subscribe to the WWE Network, $9.99 per month with a six-month commitment. And that's the key line right there. You will not be able to subscribe month to month, not even after those initial 6 months are up. They're selling this in six-month blocks. So when your 6 months is up, you renew for another 6 months. Now, you can cancel anytime you want to, but you're still bound by the 6 months, so you would have to still pay the $60. So that's how that's going to work. There's been a lot of confusion. Oh, well, how, you know, is it 6 months all throughout? Or when the 6 months is up, you could just pay $9.95 a month. It doesn't work that way. All 12 annual pay-per-views will be offered on the network, starting with WrestleMania 30. Traditionally, the pay-per-views would end up costing, I think the figure they threw out at the presentation was $675 annually if you order them through traditional means. You'll still be able to order the pay-per-views through your cable company if you want to. Maybe not if you're a DirecTV customer. We'll get to that in a little bit. But with the network, it only costs you about $120 a year. So that's a great selling point. To me, that is the selling point of this network. The fact that you can save a ton of money on the pay-per-views by simply subscribing, and even if you don't have any interest in the other content, and most people will, it's not like people are just going to sign up for the pay-per-views, you will have people who will want to check out, you know, their home videos and DVDs, which they will be streaming on the network. I don't know if it'll literally be every single title. I'm very curious myself, because I wonder if, like, some of the old Coliseum videos are part of that, or if they're just talking about stuff from recent years, like documentaries and stuff. They didn't get that specific into their answer, so nobody knows. But they did say that their home video library would be available to stream. They'll be offering, you know, a ton of different original content and on-demand classic content. So most people are going to get more bang for their buck. They're not just going to order for the pay-per-views. But if you're one of these people who doesn't care about any of that other stuff, you're still ahead of the game. If you subscribe, and you are one of these people who would order every pay-per-view, and I got to tell you, I don't know very many people anymore who do that. I used to be one of those people. I haven't been for probably about a decade now. You know, getting the pay-per-views every month, it was always just something you did. They at least felt somewhat special back then. They haven't felt special in a long, long time. I just don't know very many people unless they get together in groups. I do know people who will get a group of six or seven of their friends together. I don't know really anybody who just orders every single pay-per-view, you know, 12 or 13. I think they're back down to 12 now. I just don't know very many people who do. But if you order a lot of those shows, or you may be more likely to watch them, this is a great selling point. It really is. And I will be subscribing to the network myself, largely for the classic stuff. But because economically, for me, with the pay-per-views, it's a no-brainer. If anything, I think they priced themselves too low. Not that I'm complaining. I'm not. I'm just very surprised for the amount of stuff they're giving you. It's really a steal, in my opinion. Also, all WWE, WCW, and ECW pay-per-views will be offered uncut and uncensored. That's what they said. We'll see about that one. Encores of Raw and SmackDown each week will also air on the network. I don't know if it's the day after it airs on TV. They didn't specify. It sounded like it'll be pretty much immediately after Raw and SmackDown go off the air on USA and Sci-Fi, it will be on the network. Main event, replays as well. First run episodes of Superstars and NXT are moving to the network. So NXT will have a new home. I guess that spells the end of it on Hulu. They're going to have a live daily studio show starting this summer, plus a ton of video on demand content. They did not say that every episode of Raw and SmackDown will be available on demand. They did not say that. So that's one aspect of the original report a month ago that may not be true. What they did say is that when the network launches on the 24th, it will do so with 1,500 hours of on-demand content. Now, to put that in perspective, Classics On Demand, which is being discontinued as of January 31st, gives you 20 hours every month. They will rotate content every other week. But overall, it's 20 hours of fresh content per month on Classics On Demand. So 1,500, it's a lot more than that, obviously. They will have original shows. There's a show called WWE Countdown, which just sounds like a bunch of fluff. It'll be, I think, fan-voted countdowns for, you know, best entrance music and top finishers and that kind of stuff that you've probably seen on WWE.com a million times. WrestleMania Rewind, the Monday Night War, and yes, Legends House. They showed a trailer at the presentation for Legends House. And let's just put it this way. I'm not at all surprised that Sci-Fi turned them down when they pitched the show to them. I'll watch it. I'll watch Legends House over Total Divas any day of the week. But to say that this looks like a good show would be a bold-faced lie. It looks like a complete train wreck, which is part of the reason why I think I may end up enjoying it. The network will be available in a ton of different ways, desktops and laptops through WWE.com. If you have the app on your phone or your iPad or whatever, there will not be a separate app for the network. It'll be through the main WWE app. So if you think that they're already pushing that app too much on television, you ain't seen nothing yet. Get ready for app overload, because now you can access the network through the app, and Michael Cole is going to want to show you how to do that. So just be prepared for that. It'll be available on all kinds of devices: Kindle Fire, Android, iPhone, PlayStation 3 and 4, Roku, Xbox 360. Apparently Xbox One and smart TV capability will follow later in the year, probably sometime in the summer. Most programming will be commercial free, but they said that, you know, if you look at the information on the website, they make it clear there may be limited commercial interruption during certain programs. I wonder if that means the live pay-per-views. So there will be some ads. It doesn't sound like there'll be a ton of it, so it doesn't bother me really that much. Where will it be available? This is another question that I'm still getting asked by people who just haven't been paying attention to all the details they put out. We have people who listen to this podcast from all over the world, particularly in the UK. So for you guys, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. The network will only be available here in the States when it launches on the 24th. Later this year or early 2015 is what they're saying. That is when it will be made available in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong, and the Nordic countries. That would include Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden. So you guys are going to have to wait a little bit longer. If they have any bugs to work out with this thing, I guess we'll be your guinea pigs in the meantime. They will be setting up a customer service line for people to call that day on the 24th when the network launches if they have any questions. So may God have mercy on those poor customer service reps taking calls from 10,000 wrestling fans asking if they'll be showing Chris Benoit matches. I do not envy you at all. Every show with Benoit on it will air with an advisory that talks about how the show has fictional characters that aren't real. I mean, I don't know. It sounds kind of hokey to me. I don't know why they just can't put a warning up that says WWE does not condone or endorse the actions of Chris Benoit or something to that effect. You know, I don't know why you got to go into this whole thing about you're watching a show with fake characters and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But to answer the million-dollar question, yes, Benoit will be part of the network. WWE also filed paperwork with the Securities and Exchange Commission claiming that they can build a subscriber base of 1 to 2 million by the end of this year, and they're hoping for what they call a steady rate of 2 to 3 million subscribers thereafter. Those are the goals they've set for themselves. And not surprisingly, they also say that one of the potential downsides of the network could be the loss of pay-per-view buys through traditional means, and that some carriers could drop them altogether for putting the pay-per-views on their network. Lo and behold, only a couple of days later comes the news that DirecTV may sever its ties with WWE and no longer carry their pay-per-view events in the future. They're mulling over that option as we speak. They're thinking about it. They haven't done anything, but they are not happy. And so it begins. You knew that this would piss off a lot of their partners. They're taking a big risk here, but they think it'll pay off. And you know what? I do, too. I do. I think in the long run, it's for the better. Pay-per-view is not a dying industry. It's WWE's pay-per-view business that's a dying industry. I think it's important to make that distinction. You can't say that pay-per-view is dying when Floyd Mayweather still does 2 million buys and UFC still pulls over a million buys. Or so say the estimates of what their last show did, the one where Silva broke his leg. But WWE has treated its pay-per-views like shit for so long. You know, Mania is the only one left that draws big. Rumble does well. The others don't pull numbers anywhere close to what they used to be. And it's worth noting that, you know, Classics on Demand, which I subscribe to, okay, as of 2007, the service only had about 115,000 subscribers worldwide. Now, true, not every cable provider offered it. You know, DirecTV didn't offer it, Dish. And they only offered 20 hours of old content per month. It's not like they're offering nearly the amount of content that the new network is. But the point is, Classics on Demand was not a super successful operation. I love it to death, but 115,000 subscribers is far from impressive. Same thing with their classic service on WWE.com a few years ago. I subscribed to that too because I love the classic stuff. It was $3.95 a month. And it did so well that they ended up doing away with that too and just putting everything online for free. And it's up on their YouTube channel. Full matches you could find on their YouTube channel for free. Classic content alone is not going to carry this network. They had no choice but to add pay-per-views. That's what's going to dictate whether this thing is a success or not. If they get to a million subscribers, it's not going to be because they're showing Mid-Atlantic Wrestling from 1981 and Legends House. But you throw the pay-per-views in there, plus the Raw and SmackDown Encores, plus NXT, and all of a sudden, now you have something. But it's all about those pay-per-views. Without them, it's a money loser. There's no way they get a million subscribers just off the classic stuff. There's no way. Because they've tried it before, and they failed. Now, I want to mention one other thing here. There's been a lot of media coverage. They should be really, really happy, WWE. I'm sure they are. Their stock has gone up. You know, the Associated Press, all the major media outlets and blogs, The Verge, which is a big, you know, tech website, all these different places are covering the network. And for the most part, the coverage is positive, okay? They're not mocking wrestling. They're actually saying, well, you know, this is the future here, and Vince McMahon is leading the future, and other TV networks and sports leagues should take notice. And, you know, UFC launched their own online digital channel only a few weeks ago called Fight Pass. And I read some pieces on MMA websites that said, oh, Dana White can take a page out of Vince McMahon's playbook. You know, WWE trumped UFC and all these different things. And in some ways they did, but there was one piece on the Forbes website. Now, this is Forbes. And the thing with Forbes Online is they have a lot of contributors, and I know this because of what I do for a living, is I have to pitch the media on stories. And Forbes, which is a reputable outlet, and they've got a reputable magazine, but a lot of the people who contribute pieces to the Forbes website are not Forbes writers. They're just contributors that they hire to do opinion pieces. So I don't know where this guy comes from. There was a guy who did an article on the network, and he was, you know, heaping all this lavish praise on it and praising Vince McMahon for being a genius and all this other stuff. And the title of the article, what it really was all about, was how with this new network, it changes the game as far as WWE's television rights negotiations are concerned. Because they're in the middle, as we speak, of trying to negotiate a new deal with NBC Universal. And if NBC Universal doesn't give them what they want, they're going to potentially go elsewhere. And by March 4th, we will know whether or not Raw is staying on USA and SmackDown is staying on Sci-Fi. And that's the next big story. The network now has been announced. The next big story is how the TV rights stuff shakes out. And according to this writer, this new network changes the game. This puts the ball firmly in WWE's court. He says it means WWE now holds all the cards in their television rights negotiations. And, you know, I read this, and it's just amazing to me that you can have somebody on a website like Forbes write something like that, and it just doesn't get fact-checked. Because the fact is, if Raw and SmackDown were to leave broadcast television and air on the network exclusively, let's say things don't work out with NBC Universal, nobody else wants to pick up WWE, or they do, but they don't offer enough money, and Vince says, you know what, the hell with this. We're taking our programming and we're going to put it all in the network. It would be the death of WWE. It would be the death of the network. Because the money they're looking to get, hundreds of millions of dollars, how are they going to get that money if they put all their shows on their network? That's kind of the argument that this guy is making, that they have all the leverage now. Because if things don't work out, if they don't get what they want from NBC Universal, they can just walk. They can say, hey, we got this new network. We don't need you guys. That is complete bullshit. They absolutely need those guys. They need their stuff on television. They need to make that TV rights money. So the whole point of this guy's article is just false. So I just, you know, I saw that and I'm just like, oh my God, you talk about media hyperbole. I mean, I'll subscribe to it myself. I think it's a good idea. And as a fan, I look forward to like the classic content, the cheaper pay-per-views and all that. So I think it's a good thing. I'm happy that this network is coming soon, and I hope it works out for them. But at the same time, let's, you know, be a little careful here with all this praise that this is such a genius idea. Vince McMahon is, you know, he does it again. Yeah, maybe he does, but you know what? It's dictated by circumstances that are not in his control. Like I said, this would have been a cable channel 2 years ago if he had his way. You think he wanted this to be on the internet? Fuck no. Of course not. But they saw the tea leaves and they said, okay, well, clearly we're not going to get the deal we're looking for as a cable channel, so let's just build this up as an internet property and just go from there. And as far as the TV rights stuff is concerned, that could not be further from the truth. Vince McMahon will be meeting with the entire roster before Raw this week to discuss the launch of the network. A lot of wrestlers, understandably, very nervous about how shifting all of these pay-per-views over to the network will affect their pay-per-view bonus checks, especially for a show like WrestleMania, which is typically their biggest payday of the year. Also, royalties for DVDs and stuff like that. If you're just going to put that stuff on the network, how does it affect that? You know, WWE said their entire home video library would be available. So this affects every aspect of WWE's business. And justifiably, a lot of the wrestlers are wondering, how does that affect me? How does that affect my wallet? So I guess they'll find out more before Raw Monday, and I'm sure word will leak. And we will know more at that point. Let's talk about Raw this past Monday night. Live from Baltimore, Maryland, old school Raw. Got some random observations here just to run through. First of all, pathetic crowd for Raw on Monday night. I don't know what was up in Baltimore. I don't know if Baltimore is typically a good crowd or a bad crowd. I think most of the East Coast crowds typically are pretty good. So I don't know what it was, but this crowd was narcoleptic all night. They would come alive for certain things, but for the most part, they were just kind of there. They didn't really react, especially to some of the big cameos on the show. Jerry Lawler was not on Raw Monday night. There was a health scare with him before the show. They got him back to the arena after he was released from the hospital. They did some tests. Everything checked out okay. People worried about his heart. So he came back to the arena. Vince decided, we're not going to put you on the air. But he did an interview on the app with Josh Matthews, and he claims it was bad seafood. He was in the mall with his girlfriend. He was already not feeling right, had some seafood, and then lost his lunch all over the floor in front of everybody. And I guess word got back to the building about him not being in good shape, and it just kind of spiraled from there. But the way they handled this was kind of sleazy, because what happened is they came on the air. There was a lot of chatter on the internet and people very concerned leading into Raw that, you know, did Lawler have a heart attack? Is he okay? Oh my God, now he's not on the show. And they show Cole and JBL at ringside, and Cole just says, you know, Lawler isn't here. He wasn't feeling well. I think they made it clear that it wasn't his heart. I do think they mentioned that, but basically at that point they said, if you want to know what happened to Jerry Lawler, you got to go on the app. Go on the app. He'll be on the app doing an interview and you can find out exactly what happened. Now, it's not as sleazy as back in the day when they'd make you call a 900 hotline for news that wasn't even true. You know, but still. Jerry's not dead, but he got sick, and if you want to know why he's not here, go to the app. I don't know, it just came off as kind of low rent to me. Ric Flair, back on the show, first time in, I don't even know when the last time Ric Flair was on television. His last appearance for the company was that 2K14 video game panel. We all know what happened there. So he came out, got a big reaction. John Cena and Randy Orton were part of this segment as well. It was actually the only time in the entire show that Cena and Orton made appearances as they continued to hype their match at the Royal Rumble. Segment ended with Flair and Cena strutting. Crowd reacted to Cena favorably. I assume that's why they put him out there to endorse Flair and to strut with Flair. They were probably worried about him getting booed. Then we had the Raw debut of Daniel Wyatt. Yes, Daniel Bryan, a member of the Wyatt family. It was Bryan, Harper, and Rowan with Bray Wyatt sitting outside. They took on Rey Mysterio and the Usos in a six-man tag. And they lost their first week together, and they lose. And next week, it's going to be Daniel Bryan teaming up with Bray Wyatt against Jimmy and Jay. I'm still intrigued to see where this angle goes, and I'm still sticking with the idea that it's all part of a ruse by Bryan. He's got a plan. We'll probably see his plan unfold in the Rumble match. But man, there sure was no hint of that on this show at all. And the crowd apathy towards Bryan was just almost scary. Now, I think they'll come around when he turns on them, but they better have a good idea where they're going with this thing, because this guy went from being the hottest thing in the company to, you know, Duke the Dumpster Daniel on Monday night, and the crowd just didn't know how to react to it. And I give them until the Rumble. I think whatever's going to happen is going to happen at the Rumble. They can do a split then. I think to keep him as part of the Wyatt family through WrestleMania is a big, big mistake if that's the direction they're going in here. I don't think you can drag this out for too long until you're going to reach a point where you start to do damage to the guy. And there's people who already think Daniel Bryan is dead. Daniel Bryan is not dead. Okay, it's an interesting twist in the story. I'm curious to see where it goes. I give them until the Rumble. Beyond the Rumble, if he's still coming out there dressed like a garbage man and nothing has changed and the fans still are apathetic towards him, then it was a big mistake. So they've got a few more weeks. By the Rumble, he will have been with them for almost a month, or about a month at that point. That's plenty of time. I would not keep him in the same role beyond that. Whatever's going to happen should happen at the pay-per-view. Big E Langston beat Curtis Axel, but I do not mention that for any reason other than Ryback. Ryback was out there on commentary, and they immediately had him make a horse face joke about Lillian Garcia. Now, his voice was hoarse, and he apologized and said, "Oh, I've been hanging out with Lillian Garcia." I think that was the line. Whatever the line was, it was stupid. Okay, this has been a running joke for a while now. Usually it's Triple H on TV who calls her that, but here it was Ryback. It was probably Triple H in Ryback's ear, for all I know, feeding her that line. Apparently they think Lillian Garcia looks like a barnyard animal. Be a star, my ass. Speaking of Ryback, he beat Dolph Ziggler in a Superstars match earlier in the night and concussed him on a stiff meat hook clothesline. That's Dolph's second major concussion in less than a year. I say major because they sent him, I think, already to a neurologist out in Pittsburgh. So hopefully everything works out for him. Apparently he went, all the tests seemed to come out okay. So it was a positive report coming out of that doctor's visit. And they're going to have him start doing some light cardio exercise. If everything goes okay, then they will, I guess, do more tests. And who knows, maybe he could be cleared and he could be back on television in 2 or 3 weeks. But, you know, when you get a concussion like that, the one he got last, I think it was May, when Swagger kicked him in the head, and then something like this happens, it just, you know, it goes from bad to worse for that guy. So I hope everything works out well for Dolph. Ryback had something of a Twitter meltdown yesterday. He posted a whole bunch of tweets that he then promptly deleted. It's not the first time he's done this. If you remember, when he turned heel last year and he started feuding with John Cena, he made a comment that, if I remember, I don't remember the exact comment, but it was actually kind of funny. He made a crack on Twitter about John Cena's divorce. And it, not only did he take the tweet down, he deleted his entire account. So the account was up, but all of his tweets were deleted. And apparently he does that quite often, where he'll just post stuff, but then he'll just delete every single tweet. not realizing that on his Superstars page on WWE.com, those tweets are still there. They're probably still there now if you want to go back and see what he was writing. He was writing up a storm. I actually had unfollowed him a while ago because, I mean, he would go on these rants that were just so nonsensical. It was actually annoying, but people were following him all day. They said he was posting some hilarious tweets. He posted a tweet that seemed to mock Ziggler's concussion and mock, I guess, the internet reports that he had gotten punished or had heat on him. He had another tweet that he said, you know, Big E Langston, the Big E refers to his bra size. I mean, he was posting just a whole bunch of different stuff. And then he posted something about how he had just gotten released and followed that up later on with a tweet noting that he was pulled over by cops. I don't know. I guess he may have been pulled over by the cops, and I guess that comment was in reference. He had just been released from custody. He is not released from WWE. If he does have any heat on him, I'm sure there are people who are not happy that he injured Dolph. I don't think it's the first time he's injured somebody. But he is still on the roster. He has not been fired. And a lot of those comments were in character. But you got to be careful with that kind of stuff. I mean, look, when he posted the Cena thing, I thought it was funny. And it would be kind of nice if they let him show that kind of personality more often on television, you know, and maybe he would have gotten over even more. I just think Ryback is a lost cause at this point. But when you post stuff like that on Twitter, like if I'm in his position, I wouldn't be posting stuff like that just because the wrong people in WWE see that and you're screwed. You know, people take that the wrong way. Don't worry about tweeting funny, stupid comments. Why don't you try to incorporate that into your character on television? Why don't you fight for that? Fight to be able to show some more of your personality on TV. If Ryback is a genuinely funny guy, then let him show that on TV. Don't let him go on commentary, oh, you know, Lillian Garcia has a horse face. That's not my idea of comedy. Let him go on TV and show his real personality, and maybe he'll get over that way. He sure as hell ain't getting over doing whatever he's doing now. I thought the Piper's Pit segment with the Shield was awesome. Just having Dean Ambrose and Roddy Piper in the ring in a mic off, you know, face-to-face. Ambrose, to me, is kind of a hybrid mix of Piper and Brian Pillman. So seeing these two with live mics in their hands going at it was really fun. Piper can be hit or miss when he makes appearances. Sometimes he's awesome, and sometimes he just has no business being on a microphone. This was one of the good weeks, I think, for Piper. And all the guys, even Rollins. Rollins was really good in his role. Reigns, silent but deadly. He was fine in his limited role in this segment. Every member of the Shield is just awesome, and Piper is great. I love this segment. CM Punk and New Age Outlaws came out to make the save when they started threatening Piper. Del Rio finally got a win over Sin Cara, and after the match was over, cut a promo on Batista and how he should be the talk of the Royal Rumble, not Big Dave. They seem to be setting up a program between the two of them. He cut another promo on Batista at last night's house show in Buffalo. You know, maybe Del Rio is the first person to interrupt Big Dave when he comes back on Raw on the 20th. You know, probably have a match between them, maybe at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. You know, Batista's got to do something between the Rumble and WrestleMania, especially if he wins the Rumble, and he's going to get the title shot. WrestleMania is not until April. What does he do in the meantime? Del Rio's not doing anything. You know what? Del Rio, I have no problem with them sacrificing Del Rio for Batista. So if that's the idea here, it gives Batista something to do. I got no problem with that. They officially announced Batista would be in the Royal Rumble match, so I would imagine there'll be some interaction between the two of them in there. And another interesting wrinkle in all of this stems from a Twitter exchange that the two of them had. And I just got done talking about Ryback. If there's one lesson to be learned here is that there is nothing positive to be gained from wrestlers having access to Twitter. I'm starting to think this Twitter thing is just a horrible thing if you're a pro wrestler. But on Monday night, we heard Del Rio make some comments about Batista. Obviously, he was supposed to. And Batista went on Twitter and said, you know, who is Alberto Del Rio? Pretending like he didn't even know who the guy was. So Del Rio responded back to him by saying something to the effect of, you know, I'm the one who was winning all the championships in WWE while you were getting your ass kicked by some plumber. And that was in reference to the one MMA fight that Batista had. And the guy, I think Batista won that fight. But anyway, Batista then wrote a tweet back that he took down. And when you have to take down a tweet, you know that you probably shouldn't have written it in the first place. He wrote a tweet that said, "It seems to me that some C-level stars in a B-level star era have bought into their own hype. Don't turn a work into a shoot. #realitycheck." Again, he took it down, and supposedly that has ruffled a few feathers behind the scenes in WWE. Some guys read that and said, huh, that's quite the insult to the guys on the roster today, saying that, you know, we're in a B-level star era. And look, even if that's true, even if you look at this era as not even being comparable to, you know, the Attitude Era, the Ruthless Aggression Era, there aren't as many stars. There aren't as many stars like Batista as there used to be 10, 15 years ago. That's true. But I could see we're making a comment like that, even if this whole thing is they're just trying to work things up into a program between the two of them. Didn't really register with a lot of guys, I guess, behind the scenes in WWE, and some people were bothered by that. And we'll see when Batista comes back if it poses an issue. It makes me wonder if Batista's going to come back as a heel. I mean, when he comes back on the 20th, he'll be the biggest babyface in the world. He's going to get a hero's welcome. But then at some point after that, do you turn him heel? I don't know. I mean, if they're setting up Batista Orton, then that would tell me no. But nobody was a bigger fan of the Big Dave character than I was before he went away, when he would come out there and he would rag on the fans and he would rag on Cena. You know, like Hollywood Batista reminded me a lot of Hollywood Rock. I love that character. I would love for him to go back to that character. So if he's coming back as a heel, maybe it makes more sense for him to be making comments like that. But there were some people who were bothered by that behind the scenes in WWE. Batista signed a 2-year contract, so he's coming back. He's going to be back for a while. He's not going anywhere. I'm sure in the end this will all be smoothed over and everything will be fine. But Twitter, causing a lot of problems. Man, can you imagine Twitter back in the day, if they had a Twitter like in the 80s, when all these guys were all coked up and everything else? Can you imagine some of the tweets we would have gotten from like the Legion of Doom? Even guys like Jake and oh my God, I can only imagine what some of these things, that probably would have been really entertaining. I mean, those guys' minds were completely warped back in the day. I mean, now everything is so sanitary and PG, even these tweets. I mean, they're controversial, I guess, to some people, but it's not like anything completely outrageous is being said. I think it would be a completely different thing if, let's say, 1988 there was Twitter and you had these guys on like a Coke binge shooting up, you know, all roided up monsters just, you know, typing away and the stuff. I mean, you think the Ultimate Warrior promos back in the day, nobody seemed to understand a word he was saying. Imagine that in 140 characters or less. I think it would be actually very entertaining. Brock Lesnar was back on the show this past week. He fractured Mark Henry's arm with the Kimura lock. Big Show came out to confront him. Big Show literally flinging Brock across the ring. Brock landed right on his head and shoulder. He's okay. And on Miz TV with Big Show and Paul Heyman on SmackDown, they officially set up the match for the Royal Rumble. It will be Big Show against Brock Lesnar. I really like the idea of Big Show and Brock. I think I just talked about that a week or two ago. As an undercard match at the Rumble, it's not the main event. Again, Big Show should not be main eventing on pay-per-view, but as an undercard match, I think it's a perfectly fine idea, you know, and it's nice to get Brock on a show other than just WrestleMania. And SummerSlam, now he'll be on the Rumble. His first Rumble, I believe, in a decade. And the last time he was at the Rumble would have been 04. I think that was the match he had with Bob Holly. And the year before that, in 03, it was actually Brock and Big Show. So here we are 11 years later, and history repeats itself. But a lot of the matches they had back then were actually really good. There were some underrated matches. The Judgment Day stretcher match, I talked about this already. These guys had a good chemistry. Brock and Big Show, I like the idea of Brock and Big Show, especially with Brock going over. He beats a big guy, gets Big Show up, F5s him, and moves on to, you know, I guess challenge either for the championship at Elimination Chamber. Maybe he'll be in the Chamber match. Somehow this will tie in into the Undertaker match at WrestleMania this year, which I think is still the plan to do Brock and Undertaker. But to go back to the Rumble, having Brock and Big Show on the undercard, just having Brock on the show, plus you got Cena and Orton. I'm not saying Cena and Orton is some big attraction. It's been done a million times. I like the idea of Cena Orton just because that means we're not getting it at WrestleMania. Let this be it for John Cena and Randy Orton. Let them move on to other things. This should be the blow-off. And again, I love how it starts with a TLC match and it builds to a straight wrestling match, which is what we're getting at the pay-per-view. But Cena and Orton are still two of the biggest stars in the company. You got Brock and Big Show. You got the 30-man Rumble match with Batista coming back. And all of a sudden, you know, the Rumble looks like a pretty big attraction this year. It feels like a bigger deal than most pay-per-views. So I like that. The Diva stopwatch this week, 3 minutes 49 seconds, which is pretty decent. Oksana and Alicia Fox beat the Bella Twins. They're really putting Oksana over strong of late. I had remembered reading that Triple H was high on her. And it certainly has been showing, because before these last few weeks, I couldn't tell you the last time Oksana even won a match. All of a sudden, she's like the Goldberg of the Divas division. You know, Goldsana, they could start calling her. Or maybe Ockberg. How about that? A combination of Oksana and Goldberg. Ockberg. Actually, I kind of like Goldsana. That's not a terrible name. Heath Slater is back. He and 3MB lost to Rikishi and Too Cool. Crowd was awful here. Although they did pop for the worm, I will say. But the crowd just looked like they couldn't care any less. Like, they didn't even know who these guys were. It was so sad. But I enjoyed this a lot. We haven't seen Rikishi and Too Cool together in a long time. We've seen at different points, you know, Grandmaster Sexay was brought back to do something with his dad a few years ago. I think Rikishi popped up on TV a while back, but never together. So it was cool to see the three of them back. And Scotty's doing well for himself. Scotty's a fireman now. He looked like he was in great shape. I enjoyed this. Then they had all the legends come out, including the Godfather, who came out with the legends instead of his women. I guess the legends were his hoes on this show. Ric Flair was dancing with him. That was quite the sight. And then Bad News Barrett appeared high up on his podium. He insulted all the legends. Flair just had this look on his face. Like, he's looking up at this guy like, that poor bastard. You know, even he knows Barrett is better than this. Mean Gene Okerlund showed up, poked fun at his old 900 hotlines. All of two people in the audience got the joke, which Gene actually acknowledged, which actually made it funny. Mean Gene is just awesome on his feet. You know, even at his age, and he's getting up there in years, but he's still very sharp. He was always very good like that. I remember he was backstage interviewing Hulk Hogan at the Royal Rumble. Would have been in 91 when Slaughter was the Iraqi sympathizer. He had just beaten Warrior for the belt. And Hogan got all worked up during the promo, and suddenly he forgot Saddam Hussein's name. I think he ended up calling him like Sudan Hussein or something like that. But he just froze. He froze up, and Gene had to jump in, and he kind of saved him, sort of. Yeah, he was good with stuff like that. Or when he dropped the F-bomb that one time on the air at SummerSlam in 89, when the SummerSlam... He was about to interview Rick Rude backstage with Bobby Heenan. And literally, the camera had just gone on them, and the SummerSlam sign, it was like a cardboard logo sign, in the background, just kind of fell over. It was like on a ledge, and it just tipped over. And Gene didn't know what it was. He didn't know what had happened. And he dropped the F-bomb, turned around to see what had just happened. And you can hear, if you pay attention in the background when the sign falls, you can actually hear Vince McMahon off camera just say, "Nice move." And they went back to Shivani in a crowd shot, and Shivani's like, "All right, I think they're ready for us now." And they go back, and Gene just goes on from there like nothing ever happened. There's only one Mean Gene. CM Punk and Roman Reigns in the main event. I like this match a lot. It was kind of sluggish early on. It really picked up as it went on. Turned into a really good match. Fans were going nuts for the near falls. When Roman Reigns does the turn, whether it's WrestleMania or the Rumble or whenever it is, you know, with that Superman punch and that spear, he's going to be money. He could be their top guy, you know, when Cena gets knocked off that pedestal or when Cena is done. I could see somebody like him. You know, he looks the part. The fans are into him. He's going to be big. And he got a big win over CM Punk in this match, in fact. The other members of the Shield have all failed. Ambrose has been beaten. I think every single match he's ever had with Punk, Ambrose loses. Rollins lost. Reigns got the big win, which I guess means that Reigns is the best member of the Shield. I'm sure that's going to play into this whole story of dissension within the ranks. The only negative of this that I can point to, because I like the match. I love the Jake the Snake cameo. He came out. He looked good. It was good seeing him. If I had one criticism of this, doing the Jake cameo here the way they did, it kind of overshadowed Reigns' win. When I was going back over my Raw thoughts in my head, I actually had to stop myself. I forgot who won the match. I thought maybe it was a DQ or it got thrown away, and then I had to remind myself, no, wait a minute, Roman Reigns won. And that should be a really big deal, the fact that he got, you know, a win, a pinfall win over CM Punk, especially where the other members of the Shield couldn't. But I forgot about it because all everybody was talking about when this was over was Jake the Snake. They weren't talking about, hey, Roman Reigns just beat CM Punk. That would be my one criticism of this. But, you know, Jake came out, was looking good. He put the snake on Dean Ambrose. And was anybody marking out more than Dean Ambrose was on this show? He could not hide that smile on his face when this was over. Think about it. He got to duel with Roddy Piper on the mic. He got to brawl with the New Age Outlaws. Then he had Jake the Snake put his snake on him. You could tell he was having a blast. And by the way, I'm not sure why everybody keeps calling the snake Damien. Okay, Damien died years ago. Okay, Revelations was his next snake. This snake actually looked more like Revelations than Damien anyway. There's only one Damien, people, okay? And Earthquake squashed him. Come on, get your wrestling history straight here. What do you do with Jake now? I mean, do you put him in the Rumble? I guess you could. When this was over, my first thought was, well, I guess that's not happening because we already got to see him on Raw. But then I realized we didn't get a DDT. And it makes me wonder if perhaps the reason we didn't get a DDT is because they're saving it for the Rumble. Jake wants desperately to be in the Rumble. You know, maybe they're just going to give him what he wants. Maybe he'll be a surprise entrant in the Rumble. He'll get to DDT somebody, Heath Slater, whoever. I wouldn't mind seeing it. I would still love to see him come out and get that one big move, you know, in the Rumble match. It's not like he can't do it. You know, he does indie shots where he gives people DDT, so physically he's able to do it. It's just a matter of whether or not they want him there. So we'll see. But they definitely need to get him in the Hall of Fame this year. I think that just goes without saying. It's where he got his start. I'd say do a Mid-South class for the Hall of Fame. You know, they just released the DVD. The problem is most of those guys are already in. You know, Bill Watts, Ted DiBiase, Jim Duggan, JYD. You know, maybe they could put Dr. Death, Steve Williams, in the Hall of Fame this year. Here's what you can do. You headline with The Ultimate Warrior, since it sounds like he and WWE have reached some sort of deal. Okay, so The Warrior goes in. You put Jake in there. You put Paul Bearer in there. And Dr. Death could be your posthumous induction. I mean, you could throw the Fabulous Freebirds in there, too. They're long overdue for a Hall of Fame induction. But that's two more dead guys. You know, Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts. I don't think you want to do three in 1 year. I think that'd probably be too much. Thumbs up to Old School Raw. I enjoyed it. One other piece of WWE news really quickly. Caitlyn is gone from the company. It was her decision. She asked for her release. It was granted. Supposedly, there were some, you know, storyline ideas that she was either promised or had, you know, hopes for. They really weren't doing anything with her, if you think about it. She was just one of the non-Total Divas women that they would put in these random 10 women tags or 12 women tags. And she's getting married soon, so a combination of her getting married and her just not doing much on television, it's understandable why she would just want to step away from it. So that's what's happening here. And a lot of upset people who have emailed me saying, oh, this is a terrible decision. Number one, again, it's not WWE's call. Let's get that clear. Number two, I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, I like Caitlyn in that she had improved a little bit. You know, she was easy on the eyes and all that, of course. But it wasn't like she was prominently featured on television or she was one of the best in-ring divas on the roster. She was just kind of there. I don't really see it as being any sort of major loss. If it was AJ, you know, even if it was Natalya or something like that, that would be a bigger deal. Caitlyn leaving, as far as I'm concerned, all that does is open up a roster spot for another diva, which may be high time that they bring Paige up to the main roster, whether it's or Emma or somebody else. Just get a new face up there. You know, this could actually be a positive, I think, for the Divas division. So we'll see what happens. NXT, pretty dull episode this past week, got to be honest. Bayley, speaking of Natalya, Natalya was in Bayley's corner. Bayley went one-on-one with Summer Rae of the beautiful, fierce females and got a win over Summer Rae with her belly-to-Bayley suplex. That's what she calls it, belly-to-Bayley. Aiden English beat Colin Cassidy. This was a playoff of the sing-off from last week where Cassidy outshined English. English attacked him. That led to this match. And Aiden English beat the guy clean with his finish, which his finish looks kind of clunky. And I was surprised because Colin Cassidy is a big dude. And, you know, he got some offense in this match, but he just got beat by Aiden English. And it kind of came out of nowhere. And I don't know, just kind of surprised me. Tyler Breeze and Adrian Neville had a backstage segment. They made a match between the two of them for NXT this upcoming week. You know, I don't know if it's the accent that he has or what it is, but whenever Neville speaks, he sounds like he's got marbles in his mouth. I'm not saying that all people with an accent have marbles in their mouth. I'm saying he specifically, when he speaks, it almost sounds like maybe he's got something in his mouth. Like, I don't know, does he have a retainer or something? I don't know. He sounds like he's got marbles in his mouth whenever he speaks. I noticed that. Alexander Rusev beat Xavier Woods. Libertarian Kane made his NXT debut. He told Woods that the authority has not forgotten that it was he who spearheaded that petition to help Big Show get his job back. I was blown away. Blown away when I heard Kane say this. Some storyline continuity on NXT. I was amazed that they would remember that storyline. And so that was his punishment. They brought Rusev out. Rusev beat Woods, and that was that. We got a WWE.com video afterwards. Kofi Kingston, it was after his loss to Alexander Rusev the week before. He says he doesn't want to make any excuses, and then proceeds to make excuses. Talks about how Lana was shouting some stuff in Russian at him on the outside that he didn't understand, and he was distracted. So he challenged Rusev to a rematch this upcoming Wednesday. Don't tell me he's beaten Rusev on that show. Please don't tell me. Maybe he won't. We'll see. But I'm not optimistic. This is one of those cases where even Steven booking, I think, does more harm than good. You got a big win over a main roster guy last week. I talked about how Rusev and Emma both got to beat main roster people. Okay, Emma beat, not only did she beat Natalya, she tapped her out. Rusev tapped out Kofi. Big wins for them, right? Now they're going to turn around and have Kofi beat him, aren't they? I haven't read the spoilers, so I don't know, but I bet they do. Tyson Kidd beat Baron Corbin, who we are told was famous for getting kicked out of NFL locker rooms for fighting. I don't know how badass he could be when he's losing to Tyson Kidd. He is a big dude, though, about 6'8". The Ascension in the main event beat Junico and Camacho in a Tornado Tag Team Championship match to retain their titles. I've said before, I am not a fan of these two teams in the ring together. It's like watching paint dry. I don't know why. I just find them incredibly boring together. This wasn't much better, even with the tornado tag rules where all guys were in the ring at once. Junico and Camacho, they came out to the ring riding bikes. And I don't mean Harleys or Hondas, I mean bicycles. The only thing missing were little tassels hanging from the handlebars. That's about the only thing that was missing. And they were way too small for these guys also, these bikes. They looked like they jacked them from some Girl Scouts or something. I don't know. WWE loves their stereotypes. This is the same company that used to have the Mexicools come to the ring riding lawnmowers. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised. By WWE protocol, I guess if you're a Latino, you say vato a lot and you steal bikes from kids. That's just how it is in the universe that they live in. Way more exciting than this week's episode is the news that NXT is going live on the WWE Network Thursday, February 27th. Likely just for 1 week only. It's not going to be live every single week. And possibly that may be going head-to-head for 2 hours against TNA Impact. And for those of you who don't want to know anything, spoiler alert, minor spoiler alert here. This is not spoiling any match results for the next 4 or 5 weeks of tapings, but there are two big matches that have been made for that February 27th show. So if you don't want to know, skip ahead. One match, Bo Dallas defending his NXT championship against Adrian Neville. In the first ever NXT ladder match. See, now that's the kind of match that a guy like Adrian Neville can excel in. That's pretty cool stuff there. I'm looking forward to that. And, talk about cool, Antonio Cesaro one-on-one with Sami Zayn in a 2 out of 3 falls match. Part 2. So good they had to do it twice. Zayn was apparently on crutches at the most recent set of tapings, but from what I read, he just kind of tweaked his knee. He should be good to go in a couple of weeks. Let's hope so, because it'd be a shame if they went into that match, if he did, in anything than top form. You know, I don't want Sami Zayn in there with a bum knee at 70%. These two guys need to go in there at 100% and just tear the house down. It's one of those things where it's going to be a chance for him to really break through. All eyes are going to be on that show. You know, this is being booked almost like the first NXT pay-per-view in a way. And so all eyes are going to be on that match. Cesaro is already on TV. But if Zayn wants to get there himself, he needs to go out there and just let it all hang out. And that's hard to do if you've got a bum knee. So here's hoping he recovers quickly. Paige is also hurt. I'm not sure what the injury is, but it was pointed out that she has not wrestled a match since around Thanksgiving. I didn't even notice. So whatever it is, I imagine it can't be that serious, or else we probably would have heard about it, but she is nursing an injury. Hopefully she'll be back in action soon as well. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service, and it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for the Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's time for the Impact Report. Dixie Carter held a meeting with employees in Nashville on Tuesday, saying that she is confident they can still reach an agreement with Universal Studios for, quote, additional tapings on the theme park property. Those are the words PW Insider used. On the property. In the parking lot, perhaps? I don't know. I'm sure they were confident they could re-sign AJ Styles to a new contract also, and that didn't happen. So forgive me for my lack of faith in this company. For their sake, I hope it happens. Now, another story, some good news that TNA broke earlier in the week is that they had come to terms with Challenge TV in Great Britain on a new multi-year deal to keep all of their programming free in the UK and Ireland. Sounds great, right? Good news. Well, the other big TV story as it relates to TNA, and this is way more important than any deal with Challenge TV, is the situation with Spike TV. Their deal with Spike is up this year. Their deal with Spike is up specifically in October, which means that right now, if they aren't already, they're getting ready to negotiate with Spike on an extension or a new deal, what have you. And there are people who I'm sure are working for TNA who look at this and have to be worried. They have to be worried about not just the health of TNA overall and whether or not, you know, Spike will want to keep them. And I think Spike does want to keep them because Impact this past Thursday pulled in 1.4 million viewers, which is their biggest rating in a long, long time. They're averaging a little bit less than that, but that's still a million plus viewers that they pull every week that, you know, the world's worst car chases or whatever other crappy programming they put on sometimes in the evening would do, okay? They put Cops reruns on. I'm sure Cops reruns do just fine, but I think they probably like the ratings TNA brings. So the bigger question, though, is what happens with WWE? Because I talked about this earlier. WWE is in the middle of negotiating their TV rights. I'm sure they would love to go back to NBC Universal and double or triple the money they're making now. If that doesn't happen, you have to think that there probably are conversations that would happen between WWE officials and Spike TV officials, Viacom. Now, if WWE, hypothetically speaking, were to reach a deal that would bring Raw back to Spike, that has to spell the end of TNA. And there have to be people in that company worried about that. So the quicker they can get a new contract signed with Spike, the better off they'll be. If I'm them, I sit down at the negotiating table now and try to hammer something out before I even give Vince McMahon a chance to swoop in and screw me over. That's going to be the real story with TNA to watch over the next month or two, because they've got their own TV issues, and WWE could very easily swoop in and change the face of wrestling again the way they did back in 2001 when they bought out WCW. And I don't think that would be a good thing for wrestling, because people rag on TNA all the time. The people who just blindly hate TNA for no reason, and if you watched Impact this week, it's understandable that you would feel that way, but I don't know why anybody would want TNA to fail. There always should be, at the very least, a number two, even if they are a distant number two. There always should be a number two and a number three, and that's kind of what TNA and Ring of Honor are. Why would you want that to no longer be the case? Why would you want to take that away? Why would you only want there to be one game in town? I don't understand the logic behind that. But if WWE gets back in bed with Spike and they move Raw, and TNA finds itself homeless again, not just homeless without a physical home to tape, but homeless without a network. Worst case scenario, they can become paid programming at 2 o'clock in the morning on the new WWE network. So there's always that. Let's talk about Impact this week. This show, you know, what can be said? Dixie Carter appeared in 8 different segments on this show. Guess what? That's 7 too many. Even Triple H and Stephanie do not hog up as much television time as this woman does. So the fact that Dixie was in 8 segments says all that needs to be said about this show and where this review is going here. The opening segment with Dixie and AJ Styles, they're in the ring together. She's made it very clear she does not want this man to be her champion. She is offering him a one-night-only contract, and when all is said and done, he will be done, he will be gone. She really doesn't like AJ Styles. And AJ says, listen, I got friends. There are plenty of people in the back who would love to see you fail. So AJ has his backup. This played into a storyline for the rest of the show where Dixie had the heels take out all of AJ's friends, the friends of AJ, so they could not interfere in the main event, which was no DQ, by the way. They made it a no DQ match. And she got him to sign a one-night-only contract. He called Magnus a paper champion, which brought him out. Magnus said that after tonight, there would only be one champion. This segment was incredible. It was incredible for something completely different that happened. Styles talked about taking the world title and defending it in other countries and other companies. He went to Mexico, New Japan. That wasn't New Japan. It was Wrestle One in Japan. He sure as hell wasn't defending that title in New Japan. And he talks about bringing prestige back to the title. He had to go to other companies, he says, to bring value to the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. So, in other words, he said the TNA title was essentially worthless and said to Dixie, your company sucks. This is TNA's main storyline. And he's the babyface. It's not like he's saying TNA sucks and he's a heel and people are supposed to boo and disagree. He's the babyface who people love, who people cheer for, who speaks the truth. Under Dixie Carter's power and Dixie Carter's control, TNA is no good and your title is worthless. And it took me going to Japan and Mexico to make it mean something again. So, that just saying, that's TNA's main storyline here. That's the message I got out of this segment. And just wait until the end of the show because it gets better or worse, depending on your point of view. Bromans beat Joseph Park and Eric Young after they showed ODB getting beaten up backstage by Gail Kim and Lady Tapa. Eric bailed on his partner to go save his wife, just like Hogan did to Savage on the main event back in 88. Only it was Savage's girl he was saving. I don't blame Randy Savage for beating the crap out of Hulk Hogan backstage. After the match, they brought a piece of the guardrail into the ring and slammed Joe Park on it, so that's one less babyface to save AJ later in the show. Was this really necessary? Was Dixie really worried about Joseph Park, of all people, that he would run down and save the day at the end of the show? I mean, I guess if he bleeds, he can turn into Abyss. That's the storyline. But I don't know. It just seemed kind of odd to me that she would care enough to tell these two men to go take out Joe Park. It seems like a lot of effort for nothing. James Storm and Gunner had an in-ring segment together. Storm challenged him to a pole match, with Gunner's Feaster-fired briefcase hanging from the pole. They shook hands. What an idiot. What an idiot. Seriously. I never understand the logic behind this. I used to hate this when the winner of the Royal Rumble would put their title shot on the line, voluntarily, in a match at the February pay-per-view. It's like, why would you do that? Logically, why would you ever accept a match like that? You earned a title shot. It's yours. Ugh, so stupid. EC3 and Samoa Joe had a match, went to a no contest. I think it was a no contest. Maybe EC3 lost by DQ, which if he did, that would be his first loss. I don't know. It wasn't much of a match. It was really more of an angle done to take out Joe. Rockstar Spud ran down to interfere, stopped Joe from giving Ethan Carter the muscle buster, went after him. EC3 attacked Joe from behind, then took a wrench to his knee. Good grief. We went from a fucking hammer to a wrench. Somebody please take the toolbox away from these people. How about this? Let's all take bets on what tool TNA will use next on television. And no, Dixie doesn't count. I've got my money on a screwdriver. That's my bet. I'm wagering that a screwdriver is the next weapon to be used on this show. By the time that main event was over, I felt like I needed to pour myself a screwdriver. Backstage after, the doctor told Joe that he had to go get an MRI on his knee, which he was not happy about. I will say this, in spite of all this stupidity, Joe has done some of the best stuff verbally in years these past few weeks, probably because they're finally giving him the chance to speak more often. I thought his interaction with Dixie backstage was actually really good. So that's a thumbs up, at least. I give a thumbs up on that. Backstage, Sting found Storm and Gunner had been taken out by some mystery men. He confronted Dixie, blamed her for all these attacks. She pleaded ignorance, which is kind of her thing in life, you know. She told him to focus on his match later tonight. Kurt Angle came out for a steel cage warm-up before his cage match with Bobby Roode at Genesis coming up this Thursday. Roode came out. He teased that Kurt's opponent tonight would actually be him, but it was a swerve. Turned out to be Daniels and Kazarian. And Kurt Angle then proceeded to beat Bad Influence all by himself, 2-on-1 in the steel cage match. You know, I'd like to be more upset by this, but when was the last time Kaz and Daniels were treated as anything other than two losers on this show? You know? So this finish actually made perfect sense. You have the Bromans as your tag team champions, and then who else is there? Chavo and Hernandez, I don't even think are a team anymore. Gunner and Storm are finished. They have no tag teams. You'd think they'd actually do something with two of the best guys on their roster. This is one of the many reasons this company is going down the tubes, and it sucks, because if they do, it's not like WWE is going to pick up guys like Kaz and Daniels, which means they're out of work. They're back on the indies. I want to see these men on my TV every week, but not if they're just going to be used as enhancement guys. As a match, it was the best thing on the entire show, I will say that. You know, it had to be, given who was in it. I mean, let's be honest. They did a pretty innovative spot where Kurt gave Kaz a German suplex off the top rope onto Daniels, which looked very impressive. Kurt won with an angle slam on who else? Kazarian. He always takes the losing fall. It must be in the guy's contract or something that he has to be the one to always take the losing fall in their tag matches. Dixie told Roode backstage that he would be in a cage match tonight against Sting, which set Roode off. He was not happy. Dixie told him to calm down. Trust me. It will be taken care of, she said. Then came a hilarious scene backstage where Kurt Angle was posing for pictures with some random family. He appeared to be completely oblivious to the fact that all of his babyface colleagues were being picked off one by one. Suddenly, Al Snow drives up and says Kurt has to come with him to the airport. There's been some sort of emergency. And so off goes Kurt Angle with Al Snow, and Dixie's obviously up to her old tricks, got Kurt out of the building. Then it was time for Bobby Roode and Sting inside the steel cage. You know, they had two cage matches on this show. They have another cage match scheduled for Genesis this week with Angle and Roode. And in 2 months, we've got Lockdown, which is a concept built entirely around the steel cage. It's one of the few pay-per-views that TNA is actually going to have this year. I think it's on March 9th or whatever that Sunday is. So why are they giving away so many cage matches so soon before Lockdown? Why ask why? Sting had Roode beat in the Scorpion Deathlock. And man, is it ever obvious that Sting he cannot bend his knees anymore. I said it before on this podcast. He needs to retire the Scorpion and just stick with the Death Drop as his finish. He looks so bad when he tries to do that move now. Of course, EC3 and Spud ran down. They distracted the referee. Spud passed a baton to Bobby Roode through the cage, which he used on Sting, and this allowed him to walk out the door to victory. Why was Roode so concerned that the referee shouldn't see him using the baton? It's a steel cage match. They were very careful to do this behind the referee's back. Are there DQs in TNA cage matches now? Maybe there is. I think, wasn't there a time where there was a period of time where I think the TNA world title could change hands on a DQ? They've had stupid rules like that before. Maybe I missed something. Maybe you can be DQ'd in a cage match in TNA. I just thought that was kind of dumb. Then we had a pre-taped segment at a funeral home with Ken Anderson and Bully Ray doing his emo teenager shtick. They played the fucking cheesy music in the background after I complimented them for ditching it last week. Last time I ever do that. He again pulled out a lighter. He threatened to burn everything to the ground. So to summarize this whole segment here, Anderson took everything away from Bully. Aces and eights, everything. He took it all away from him. And he told Anderson, go take a look in the casket. The casket was still there. This was the same chapel they used for that awesome Aces and Eights funeral segment a couple of months back, which was one of my favorite TV segments on any wrestling show all year. Okay, when TNA fires on all cylinders and gets something right, I praise them. And that segment was awesome. And this was the same place where they filmed it. And it's hard for me to believe the same people who booked this show were responsible for that segment, but apparently they were. When Anderson went over to the casket, he pulled out two towels or blankets, I think maybe they were, symbolizing the twins that his wife is expecting. And when Anderson turned back around, Bully was gone, just off into the wind somewhere. Backstage, Sting, having recovered from his baton beating, said nothing was going to stop him from watching AJ's back in the main event. And Dixie reminded him that it's about that time of year when they talk about renewing his contract and sweetening the pot. Sting said, money can't buy me. And she told him to make the right decision. Now, I didn't watch this show until Friday. And so I got a ton of tweets from people after it aired, just absolutely tearing the main event to shreds. Some even called it the worst match they had ever seen. Having watched it, it was not the worst match I've ever seen, not even close. In fact, toward the end, it had some great crowd heat. You know, the crowd was really behind AJ Styles. And therein lies the problem. If AJ really is gone from the company, and I believe he is, at least for now, I believe he is, then this was about the stupidest fucking finish you could have come up with. I mean, a chimpanzee with attention deficit disorder could have come up with a better finish. Every heel in the company interfered in this match. It was an overbooked mess. Absolutely, it was an overbooked mess. But they were telling a story here, that being that Dixie hates AJ, and she was prepared to do everything in her power to make sure that he didn't leave with her title. EC3 and Spud ran in and jumped AJ, but he fought them off. Sting ran down for the assist. Then the bromans with DJ Zima Ion came out to interfere. Styles kept kicking out of every near fall. He would get his ass kicked, and he would kick out. Kaz and Daniels ran in to attack Styles. Magnus again tried for a cover, but AJ kicked out. Earl Hebner was more and more reluctant to count each time, even though this was a no DQ match, you know, because I guess Earl Hebner has integrity. He would never want to screw anybody over or anything like that. Finally, he could take no more. He left the ring. He even decked Rockstar Spud on his way out. Dixie walked out with Earl's son Brian to take over for his dad. Sting gave the bromans a double death drop out on the floor, which actually looked cool, which just reinforces my earlier statement about him just sticking with that as his finish. Sting then helped AJ fight off bad influence in the ring. Styles put Magnus in the calf killer. Looked like he was about to tap. Kazarian, though, knocked out the referee before he could. Styles cleared out bad influence, gave Magnus the Styles clash, but there was no referee. So back out came Earl Hebner to count the fall, but he got yanked out of the ring by Daniels before the three count. Crowd was going nuts at this point. Crowd seemed to be into it. Bobby Roode finally came down. He put the nail in the coffin, laying out AJ Styles with not one, not two, but three TKOs. Dixie called out referee Brian Stifler to count the fall as Magnus covered Styles. And Magnus is your undisputed, they said, TNA World Heavyweight Champion. Hell of a way to crown an undisputed champion. Makes me appreciate that finish that WWE gave us at TLC even more. At least Orton beat Cena clean to win both belts. Orton came out of that looking somewhat strong. Magnus came out of this looking like a chump. You'd think with AJ on his way out, they could have at least given Magnus some credibility. A little bit of cred at AJ's expense. I understand that Magnus is a heel. He's a bad guy. He takes shortcuts. I get that. But nobody buys Magnus as a world champion. I like that they're giving him the ball to run with. I was in favor of the decision. But this doesn't exactly help his cause. All the heat is on Dixie. There is no heat on Magnus at all. It's all on her. She is in almost every fucking segment on the show. And the show ends with her master plan to screw AJ over for the belt. It wasn't some diabolical plan that Magnus masterminded. He's just another guy. He needs all the help he can get right now. And this finish does nothing to help him. And as Matt DiNapoli pointed out on our Facebook group page, in the last few months, these are the men that Magnus has been given wins over. Samoa Joe, Kurt Angle, Sting, Jeff Hardy, and now AJ Styles. He has beaten every big name in the company. And yet, what does it all mean? He doesn't feel any more special. People should be able to look at this guy right now and say, man, I hate that guy, Magnus. He turned his back on the fans. He's a prick. But damn, he's beaten Sting. He's beaten all of these guys. He's earned it. He deserves to be in that upper echelon of guys in TNA. This guy's the real deal. Instead, he's a chump, and nobody takes him seriously as the champion, certainly not after that clusterfuck we got on Thursday. The only thing missing from that main event was Paul Bearer and AJ Styles being resurrected and raised to the ceiling when it was over. It was Royal Rumble 94 all over again. The Undertaker-Yokozuna casket match. Every heel in the company ran out to beat The Undertaker. It took 10 men to put him down. It took a little less than 10 to put AJ Styles down, but boy, he came out of this looking like Superman. And he doesn't even have a contract. He's booked up at Ring of Honor TV tapings for the next few months. Now maybe he and TNA reach a deal at some point, and he comes back in March or April. Maybe he does. But I believe him when he says he's not signed to a deal right now. And if that's the case, this booking is just baffling to me. Now, the other thing is that they've done nothing to set up who the next big babyface challenger is going to be. I would guess Samoa Joe, because after him, the pickings are slim. Jeff Hardy is out until March, and he already wrestled for the title, and he lost. Hardy is played out. Anderson is busy with Bully, and shouldn't be wrestling for the title anyway. Sting and Kurt Angle are not the answer. They've buried James Storm. Gunner has the briefcase for now, unless he loses it to Storm, but Gunner's got the briefcase. It belongs to him, and Gunner is at least somebody new, but yeah, I don't know. I just don't see it. I don't think a Gunner-Magnus feud is going to do much good for TNA. In my opinion, the two guys they should be building around are Samoa Joe and Austin Aries. Through everything TNA has done to these two guys, the crowds are still hot for them. They can carry things in the ring. They're good on the mic. Joe especially of late. He's been great. Aries wasn't even on the show this week. Now's their chance to right the ship with Samoa Joe. They've done themselves a disservice by burying this guy in the mid-card for the last 5 years. At one time, he was the hottest babyface they had. He was the guy they could have built around. He actually sold a ton of pay-per-views with Kurt Angle, and then they killed him for reasons that still have not been explained to me. Build up Joe, build up Aries as challengers to Magnus. I like Bobby Roode as a heel. I wouldn't turn him, so I don't think him against Magnus works right now. But keep Roode in that mix too, though, somewhere, because he's too good for that company to be doing anything less with him. But these are the things, constructive criticism on my part, these are the things that they should be doing. Those are the guys that they should be building around. And they should be doing everything in their power to build Magnus up as much as they can. He can be a prick, he can be a heel, that's fine. But he's what, 27 years old, 28? He signed a 5-year contract not too long ago with TNA. He's locked in. He's loyal. He's dedicated. Okay, you can build around him. People already have a hard enough time buying into this guy as champion. I applauded the move, and I had people emailing me saying, oh, Magnus is the TNA champion. What a joke. You know what? They're right. They have every right to believe that, because TNA has done nothing to convince them otherwise. You can put him over on Sting and Hardy and all these different guys, and the win over Sting back at Bound for Glory was a clean win. The win over Hardy wasn't, but the win over Sting was. And it's like when Bryan beat Cena at SummerSlam. Big win, right? Not too many people get to beat John Cena clean in the middle of the ring with their finish. And what did it really amount to, given where he is now? They squandered that win. And TNA, on a much smaller level, you can say, kind of did the same thing when he beat Sting. But they're doing this guy no favors. And it's funny to me that when I make comments like this, or I go off on TNA, all the TNA diehards, they get all their undies just get rolled up in a bunch. They get so offended when you say the slightest thing wrong about TNA. The TNA diehard fans, you know what they remind me of? They're like Officer Bar Brady from South Park. Like, there's nothing wrong. Everything is fine. Nothing to see here, people. Move along. Everything is cool in TNA. They got no problems. They're just blown up by the internet. No, TNA has a lot of problems. They got a lot of financial problems. They got a lot of different problems, the booking should not have to be one of them. The one thing they could at least get right. You know, a lot of guys went away. Now they're focusing on the younger guys, the cheaper guys, let's be honest. They can put them in a position where people will start to take them seriously as bigger names. And who knows, maybe 6 months from now, a year from now, if TNA survives and they're still around, maybe when people look at a guy like Magnus, he'll be looked at as a legit main event guy. And maybe by then, if they get their house in order, maybe they can bring a big name in, or they can build up some other young guys, and all of a sudden, you've got a nice, robust main event scene, which is not what they have right now. There are not a lot of guys left in TNA for this guy to go up against when you take Joe and Aries out of the equation. And I just don't see what's accomplished by building everything around Dixie. Dixie is not wrestling. Dixie is not the champion. She may as well be. You may as well give her the belt. Magnus is the one who has to go in there and be taken seriously by people. Magnus is the one that people should want to see wrestle. There should be something about this guy that makes people want to see him get in the ring and either get his ass kicked or kick other people's asses. And Magnus doesn't have that right now. So I don't see what's accomplished by putting all the heat on her and none of it on him, which is exactly what happened on this show. You had AJ in that promo earlier, part of the storyline, right, calling Magnus Dixie's lapdog. They had got the crowd chanting, oh, Dixie's lapdog. That was the big crowd chant. And I thought, foolish of me to think, that what would end up happening when this match was over is that Magnus, on some level, would prove that that was not the case. He would actually stand up for himself. He would come out looking tougher. And instead, he came out looking like a loser. And that's something they're going to have to change going forward. And call it constructive criticism, call it whatever you want to. You know, that's something they're going to have to fix going forward if they want people to take this guy seriously. Let's go through some mailbag questions here. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You could also send MP3 audio questions there. Please include your name and where you are from when you send in an email. And a quick note here, I am slowly getting to all the emails you guys have been sending me over the last week or two. I know there's a ton of you that you probably either haven't heard your question on the show or haven't heard back from me directly on. I'm hoping to get through as many of those in the next several days as I can. I'm a little backlogged, so just bear with me. This comes from Hitton. I'm as excited as anybody about this new network. However, if it's a username and password enrollment, I can see a group of several family, friends, and acquaintances sharing one subscription, like people do with Netflix, and hence reduce revenue levels. Even technical glitches with millions of users logging into the live stream of one pay-per-view and the system just crashing. Luckily, I have the luxury of having to wait until later in the year, being in Canada, to find out how the network has been received. Maybe this is just the critic in me, but with these and other potential caveats, would you really rush to subscribe to this network right when it's released, when this is the first time it is going public? Well, you know, me personally, I'm going to subscribe. I'm not saying I'm going to subscribe on day one. You know, maybe I would wait a week and get the lay of the land first. That's probably the way to go. I mean, when like a new device comes out, like a new phone or a new operating system, take that for example. I am very slow to change when it comes to iOS. I'm still running iOS 6 on my iPhone, and at some point I'm sure I'll have no choice but to upgrade. But my logic initially was I want to wait and see how iOS 7 is received by people, because there could be bugs. You know, people upgrade and all of a sudden they lose stuff, or their music app doesn't work the same way, or their volume is too high. I mean, whatever the glitch is. I'm with you. I'm one of those people typically who will take a wait-and-see approach. I don't have to be the first person in line on day one. With the network, I won't be there on day one either, most likely, but you know, probably a few days later, I'll subscribe. I really don't think there's going to be huge glitches that you know, prevent you from watching all of their content. If it's a matter of the live shows, you know, well, they've got until WrestleMania to work that out. WrestleMania is not until April. So that would be when the biggest glitch might hit, and I don't have to worry about that either, because I'll actually be in New Orleans, so I'm not watching WrestleMania on my computer. You know, I'm not watching WrestleMania on my iPhone with my 4-inch screen. But the user login thing that you mentioned is kind of an interesting point. I would have to think that they'll have the technology in place to prevent that from happening, because you're right. All it would take is one person in a household to subscribe, and then if you've got four people in that household, or let's say I subscribe, and I've got five friends who want the WWE Network, well, here, you know, here's my login credentials. Go for it. So I would have to think that they'll put something in place that maybe allows for only, you know, two simultaneous logins, so that way if you've got two people in a household, they can log in, but beyond that, it won't work. I just don't know. They haven't really talked about that. Brian in Arizona, after seeing the closing segment to Raw this past Monday, all I could say was, wow, that was awesome. I got chills down my spine when Jake the Snake's music hit. My question is, seeing as how good Jake looks now, can you see him possibly being a manager to a WWE superstar? And if so, what superstar would you pair him with? I don't see him as being a manager. Frankly, I think him going back out on the road is about the worst thing that could possibly happen to him. I don't want to see that. Give him a Rumble cameo, maybe. Put him in the Hall of Fame and just leave well enough alone. Let Jake make special appearances every now and then. I'm cool with that. You know, old school Raw again next year. Great. But I think Jake is the kind of person and has the kind of personality based on just some of the things he's said before, where him going back out on the road and traveling all the time and being in any sort of, you know, stressful environment would be just devastating to whatever progress he's made. And, you know, he's back home, he's got the yoga, he's got a vegetable garden, he's got all these little things that he kind of focuses his time and efforts on. And I feel like if you take that away from him, it's like a house of cards. You know, you take one card away, the whole house falls down. I don't want to see the same thing happen with Jake. Him being a manager, what does it really matter anyway? I mean, it's not like they focus a lot on managers. You know, they got Paul Heyman out there with Brock. Jake's not going to be allowed to go out there and cut the same kind of Jake the Snake promos that you and I remember. So him being behind the scenes and maybe lending some of that knowledge to some of the younger guys, I think could be a good thing. Well, you know what? Fly him to developmental. Fly him to NXT and let him do, you know, a week down there where he works with guys in their promos. They've done that before. They've had, you know, Mickie James was at the facility working with the Divas. Eve Torres was there working with the Divas. They've flown other guys in. That would be a more appropriate role, I think, for Jake. If he could somehow contribute down at NXT, which isn't, I mean, they're in Florida. Jake, I think, lives in Georgia, I think. So he's not that far away from them. I'd like to see that. But him being back out on the road as a manager, I don't think that's a good idea. Anthony in the UK, would your opinion of the U.S. title unifying with the Intercontinental title change if WWE were to add stipulations to the belt being defended? For example, in the NWA WCW days, I think you could lose the title on a disqualification or a countout, and throwing your opponent over the top rope resulted in a DQ. I'd like to see these rules reintroduced for the title. Also, I had the idea that when every new champion wins the title, they get sworn in the same way that a president is sworn in. If they made stipulations like these in order to make the title stand out so it wasn't just another belt, would this make you think twice about a title unification? Nothing will change my mind about a title unification. The U.S. title is shit in WWE. That's just what it is. Didn't used to be, but it is. Dean Ambrose comes out there, he throws it around like it's nothing. I don't blame him. It's probably more of an inconvenience for him to carry that thing around. He never defends it. So I am still in favor of a unification. I don't care about adding stipulations to it. I mean, I remember those days. I think that was under Bill Watts where, you know, you couldn't go to the top rope and do moves, or if you got thrown out over the top, it was a DQ. So dumb. That's why they did away with them. If they were so popular, they would have kept those rules. So I'm not a fan of any kind of stipulations on a belt unless it's like a weight limit. If you have a cruiserweight division, that's a whole different ballgame, and they're not going to do that. The swearing in thing, I don't need to see that. I know where you're coming from. It makes it feel more special. They can make it feel special without having to do that. I'm still in favor of a unification. I hope they do it. I'm already reading rumors online that maybe they are going to unify the belts, possibly at Elimination Chamber. You know what? I hope they do. I hope they do. We'll have one singular undisputed world champion, one singular intercontinental champion, a pair of tag team champions, a Divas champion, and that's it. Just like it used to be. I'm not saying that every old school idea or everything about how things used to be is valid in 2014. You know what? That's one of them. Less is more. So nothing will change my mind on that. Ben from Fresno, California. I recently listened to Sound Off episode 149, as I am currently listening to past episodes, and I listened to you make the comparisons of two big press conferences for two big international stars in WWE's history, Sin Cara and Taka Michinoku. Needless to say, neither one really lived up to the hype, but which one did you think was the bigger bust? Well, Sin Cara by far. They had so much more invested in Sin Cara. First of all, I'm willing to bet they were paying him a lot more, number one. But number two, he was a huge star in Mexico. he was a far bigger star than Taka was, you know, before he ever came to WWE, wherever he was. And Sin Cara was making millions of dollars down in Mexico. So they thought, rightfully, that they could bring him up, and he wouldn't necessarily still be on that same level, but he could be their next Rey Mysterio. They were banking a lot on this guy, and they were banking a lot on his popularity. So of the two, by far, he was the bigger bust. They brought in Taka. They put the light heavyweight title on him. It wasn't like Taka was ever going to go beyond a certain level. He was a small guy, a thin guy, back at a time when being big was still something that worked to your advantage. You know, Taka was like a pipsqueak compared to some of these other guys in the main roster. He was brought in to fill a role as the face of their new light heavyweight division. Sin Cara was never brought in to be just a light heavyweight guy. So for that reason alone, Sin Cara was the bigger bust. This comes from Cliff. Out of all the men that won a world title between 2002 and 2013, which of them do you think would not have been a world champion had there only been one title? I mean, there's a lot of names that come to mind. You know, Booker T. I don't think Booker T, were it not for that world heavyweight title, would have been WWE champion. Great Khali surely would not have held a title if he didn't hold that world belt. Jack Swagger, Christian, JBL, probably Dolph Ziggler. But, you know, you have to remember, back when JBL won the WWE Championship on SmackDown, the world title was on Raw. That was the top title. But JBL still had a memorable reign because that title still meant something. They were still somewhat loyal to the brand split, not exactly, but, you know, more so than they were at the end. I've been calling for them to unify the titles for years because the world title meant nothing. It was an insult to have two world champions. It made it feel trivial, like a consolation prize for somebody who wasn't good enough to win the WWE title. So I'm glad they finally pulled the trigger, and if that means that some guys who might have otherwise been a world champion never get to hold a title, then that's okay. Because you know what? Not everybody is cut out to be a world champion. Kane from Cardiff, Wales. Do you think Steve Austin may still participate in a match at WrestleMania 30? Or if not, at least show up and do a promo. Also, what would you personally book him in? No, Austin is not wrestling. I think he's done. That's the end of that. Will he show up for a cameo? I don't know. I hope so. You know, it's WrestleMania 30. I think he should be there. What I'd like to see, you know what I would like to see, is some sort of champions roll call before the main event to really make the title match that night feel special. You know, they're going to bill it as the 30th anniversary. It's not exactly the 30th anniversary, but the point is WrestleMania number 30 is a big deal. So you get a guy like Austin out on stage for a big pop, Hogan, Warrior if he's there, Brett, Shawn, yeah, hell, maybe even Bruno, although I don't know that Bruno would want to travel for something, you know, that far, just for like a brief cameo like that. Just get a few of the biggest champions out on stage for a nice reaction, and then they part to each side of the stage as the challenger comes out and the champion comes out. And it's just a nice way to build that main event and just make it feel that much more special. Like, wow, this is the main event of WrestleMania 30. This title match is a big deal. And I don't know, you know, Batista and Randy Orton doesn't exactly come off to me as being that kind of like big-time match. Looks like that's the match we may be getting. But that's probably what I would do with Austin. I mean, what else is there for him to do? He's already been a guest referee a couple of times, right? He guest ref the infamous Lesnar-Goldberg match, and he was more over than either one of those guys. He guest ref the Cole-Lawler match, which is a match a lot of people would probably like to forget. I mean, what's he going to do? Come out and stun somebody and drink beer? We've already seen that. Let him come out, get a big pop, get some other guys out there. They can get a nice reaction. But use them in a way that's productive. I think a champion's roll call like that before the main event would actually be very, very nice. David from Sacramento, although TNA is the shits financially right now, let's say if they weren't and the current story of Magnus was still happening, would you like to see TNA bring back Bobby Lashley as the people's white knight, or in this case, black knight, to fight the Dixieland faction, I should say? I personally think he can bring up how they legally owe him a shot from winning an earlier tournament. Plus, if he did return, this could be his warm-up before coming back to WWE. Well, that shouldn't be the prerequisite for going to TNA. Oh, I'm going to use it as my way to get warmed up before I go back to Vince McMahon. If that was his goal, like if I'm TNA and Bobby Lashley comes to me and says, hey, I'm available, I want to come back, but I'm going to be honest with you, you know, I want to go back to Vince, but for now, I can come back and do some stuff with you guys, I would tell him to get lost. I don't really have any interest, though, in seeing Bobby Lashley come back. I am not enamored with the idea of Bobby Lashley, the boss, or whatever the hell they called him, coming back to TNA, nor do I think anybody would remember, except you, this tournament that he won. That was a completely different time in TNA, completely different booking team and writers and all that. It's not even, you know, this type of storyline continuity that I would endorse. It's the sort of thing that just deserves to be forgotten about, and you just kind of move on. I don't know. Lashley and TNA, if they think they can make money with him and they need a big babyface to bring in, I talked earlier about how a lot of guys have gone and they only have so many faces. He would be another face. I don't see him making that much of a difference, really. And I don't even think he would want to go back. And like you said, they can't afford him, so it's a moot point anyway. Finally here, Al writes in, what are your thoughts on Extreme Championship Wrestling back in the day as compared to Vince McMahon's ECW? Because I've heard so much about ECW when it was introduced to the world of wrestling, and it was like nothing I've ever seen before. Even though they brought us great wrestlers like Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, and others, it was always about its hardcore lifestyle. Tables, kendo sticks, crucifixions, catfights, and dropping women on their heads. And then they ran out of business, they were reincarnated by Vince McMahon, and then died. So, how do you view the legacy of ECW? Did it hurt the wrestling business? This is a loaded question. Did it hurt the wrestling business? Yes and no. And just to back up a little bit here, ECW was not about tables and crucifix. They did one crucifixion angle, and that same night, they sent Raven back out there as Scott Levy to apologize to the crowd because they realized that they fucked up. And that was the night Kurt Angle was actually there, and Kurt Angle was so offended by that angle, he walked out. But that shouldn't be the legacy of ECW. It's part of the legacy, yeah, the hardcore style, the blood, the brawling, and all that kind of stuff. And yes, they did beat up a number of women and pile drive a number of women in ECW. But the thing that I look back on ECW, what I think it'll be remembered most for, part of its legacy, and to go to your question, did it hurt the wrestling business? It hurt the wrestling business because WWE and WCW felt like they had to compete with that style of wrestling as it became more popular. And when WWE started copying ECW, and they were the first, and no matter what Vince McMahon may say, they copied off of ECW. That you go back and watch the product late 96 into 97, and ironically, that fall of 96 period is when they started working with ECW. There was a little talent exchange. They had an agreement. They did some angles on Raw and on some of the pay-per-views with ECW guys. That's when the style started to change a little bit. Tables became more prevalent and that sort of thing, and the chair shots and all that kind of stuff. For that reason, yeah, ECW was bad news for the wrestling business because all of a sudden the violence factor got ratcheted way up. Everybody felt like they had to do that to compete. And looking back on it and the chair shots to the head and all that kind of stuff, that was definitely part of the ECW influence, and that was not good. But I think ECW was equally good for the wrestling business because look at all the people who got a shot in ECW who would never have gotten a shot anywhere else. Look at Steve Austin. Look at Steve Austin. Look at Rey Mysterio. Paul Heyman brought some of these guys over to the United States for the first time. Chris Jericho. Benoit. Eddie. Malenko. I know there's other guys I'm just forgetting off the top of my head. Those are the big names that jump to mind right away. These are guys that never would have gotten noticed or never would have been given a shot. Paul Heyman gave them a shot. He brought them in. And he got them over. Or at least he gave them a chance to get themselves over, like with Austin. And that opened up a lot of people's eyes. And from ECW, guys went to WWE. Guys went to WCW. So I think you can't really paint with a broad brush. You can't say ECW was bad for wrestling. You can't say it was good. It was a little bit of both. Goes both ways. That's the legacy I think that they left. They left a legacy of really great wrestling and a lot of violence. But above all else, it was a place where guys really had a chance to come into their own as characters. Because I like that aspect of the way Paul Heyman ran his company. He was a shitty businessman, but he would see a guy, and if he wasn't really that great in the ring, okay, well, you can compensate for that in other ways. You think 9-1-1 was a good wrestler? No. But people bought into his... He would chokeslam somebody, and people would go nuts. That's what he was good for. Taz. Taz was a short guy. If Taz walked into the WWE locker room at that time, he would have been laughed right out of it. But they came up with this gimmick, this character of him as like this shooter, this tough guy who would tap people out. He would tap out guys twice his size. Al Snow. WWE didn't know what the hell to do with this guy. He came out there. He was a black ninja, shinobi. He was Avatar in a different mask. He was Leaf Cassidy, who was stuck in a time warp as part of the New Rockers. He went to ECW. He came up with this gimmick where he would walk around with a mannequin head. Somehow it got over. Don't ask me how. And then they brought him back. They said, oh, thanks, Paul. And they took him back, and he was very popular on WWE television, doing the hardcore style, because he's part of the hardcore division at that time. And the hardcore title and the 24/7 hardcore rule, that was some of the most entertaining stuff that WWE did during that Attitude Era period. Where do you think that whole notion of hardcore came from? ECW. So I would say they did more good than harm, because it gave guys a place to work. It gave guys a place where they can hone their craft and hone their character and get noticed and eventually get a better job working for WCW and make more money or working for Vince McMahon in WWE and becoming a big star like Austin did and Jericho and all those guys and Mysterio. So I think the legacy of ECW will mostly be positive, but you can't ignore the negative. And it's scary when you think of some of those ECW guys, like the really hardcore guys who were most well-known for being in ECW. Look at Balls Mahoney. I mean, I saw clips from a shoot interview that he did recently. Balls Mahoney looks like a 70-year-old elderly man. He's still very smart, and you listen to him speak, and it's amazing that his mind is as much intact as it seems to be. But you look at a guy like that, and you think, okay, well, 10 years from now, you know, is he going to be able to bend over and tie his own shoes? These guys made that choice. I mean, that's the style that a lot of those guys wrestled. And at some point, that's, you know, going to catch up with you. Would have been nice for them to take better care of themselves. But then ECW wouldn't have been ECW. Would it have been as popular if these guys weren't going out there beating each other's brains out every single week? I don't know. Maybe not. Those fans could be pretty bloodthirsty at times. I think history will look back kindly on ECW. It was part of the big network launch this week. They made it very clear that you can get old WWF, WCW, and ECW pay-per-views. They included ECW in that same category. So there's going to be a whole new generation of fans now from now on with this network who are going to be exposed to ECW, the original ECW, not the fake version later on. And I think overall, when all is said and done, history will look back kindly on the legacy of ECW.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 21 years ago this week, on January 9, 1993, Bret Hart beat Ric Flair to retain the WWF title at a house show in Boston in a 60-minute Iron Man match. There were actually several of these long before Shawn and Bret in 96. The Rockers and the Rougeaus, I think, were the first. They had a whole bunch of Iron Man tag matches at house shows back in 89 that I don't think ever aired on television anywhere. Bret won the match, 3-2, I believe, and I still haven't read Bret's book, and I really need to, but I know he's told this story before. I think this was the show where he confronted Flair backstage beforehand and chewed him out in front of the other wrestlers, including Scott Hall. He says Hall was there and can vouch for him. Something about how, you know, he was going to be the ring general that night and not Flair. Bret hated Flair's routine. Every single match, the Flair flop, the flip in the corner. You know, I mean, every wrestler has their set of spots. Bret did too. But he always thought Flair was very overrated and not as good of a wrestler as people gave him credit for. Anyway, there's fan cam footage of the match on YouTube. It's terrible quality, but it's the only copy available. 2 days later, on January 11, 1993, it was the debut of Monday Night Raw at the Manhattan Center in New York City. Had the announced team of Vince McMahon, Randy Savage, and Rob Bartlett of the Don Imus radio show. He was a radio jockey in New York. Sean Mooney outside did a whole series of skits throughout the show where Bobby Heenan was trying desperately to get inside the building. They kept telling him, Show is sold out. You can't get in. Heenan would try a different way to get in. He dressed up. Among other things, he dressed in drag and tried to get in. And he tried to dress up as a Hasidic Jew to get in. Neither worked. Yokozuna pinned Coco Beware in the very first Raw match ever to WWE Hall of Famers. Also on this show, Shawn Michaels pinned Max Moon, which was a gimmick created originally for Conan, but he did not last long in WWE, and Paul Diamond played the character instead. Ironically, Diamond was tag team partners with Shawn Michaels back in Texas in the mid-80s. They were the American Breed. That was their tag team name. And in the main event, The Undertaker pinned Damian Demento with a tombstone, and so ended the very first episode of Raw, which was a replacement show for Primetime Wrestling. Primetime Wrestling had been on the air, I believe, since 86, and it had gone through a number of different changes. I look back fondly on Primetime when Gorilla, Monsoon, and Bobby Heenan hosted on set. At some point, it changed to a roundtable format where Vince McMahon was at the head of the roundtable and he would have different wrestlers on there. That format wasn't bad, but it wasn't the same. And so Monday Night Raw, they wanted to, you know, go live with this new type of show. And that was the idea that they came up with. And that was the show that replaced Primetime Wrestling. It went from Primetime one week to Raw the next, and they haven't looked back since. 17 years ago this week, on January 8th, 1996, on an episode of Monday Night Raw, Ted DiBiase debuted his new million-dollar champion, the Ringmaster, on an episode of the Brother Love Show. 5 months later, DiBiase was gone. He changed his name to Stone Cold, debuted the Stunner as his new finish, won King of the Ring, and Austin 316 was born. Best gimmick change ever! 13 years ago this week, on January 7, 2001, the original ECW held its final pay-per-view event, Guilty as Charged, at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. Nobody knew for sure that it would be their last pay-per-view, but the writing was on the wall at this point. I think a lot of those guys knew it might be the last. Rhino pinned Sandman to win the world title. RVD beat Jerry Lynn in an impromptu main event. Justin Credible and Steve Corino cut a promo to end the show, announcing themselves as the new Impact Players. The original Impact Players included Justin Credible and Lance Storm, and I think some guy named Jason and Dawn Marie. But we never got a chance to see this new Impact Players really get going since ECW died shortly thereafter. They only ran a couple of live events after this, and that was it. Of all the promotions back then, the one that you would think would go out with a bang in a blaze of glory actually went out with a whimper. 12 years ago this week, on January 7th, 2002, Triple H made his grand return from Quad Tear No. 1 on Raw at Madison Square Garden. He got one of the biggest ovations of all time because that's New York City. That's how we roll. We have good crowds, unlike Baltimore. Had Jake the Snake Roberts made his return at MSG instead of Baltimore, I guarantee he would have gotten a hero's welcome. Triple H announced that he would be entering that year's Royal Rumble match, and then he gave Kurt Angle a pedigree. Here's a trivia note for you. That very same night, Brock Lesnar and Randy Orton both wrestled in dark matches. Brock beat Rico Constantino, and Randy beat Ron H2O Waterman. There's a name from the old OVW that I remember. Wonder whatever happened to him. I think he did some MMA. I don't know if he still is or not. At Ron Waterman. 8 years ago this week, on January 8th, 2006, WWE's second annual New Year's Revolution pay-per-view in Albany, New York, is best known for Edge cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase and winning his very first WWE Championship. John Cena had just survived an Elimination Chamber match when Vince McMahon walked out, asked them to raise the cage. He said, "We've got one more match." Out came Edge to cash in. He pinned Cena with a spear in a short match. Edge talked about this on Chris Jericho's podcast a few weeks ago about just how, you know, overall fan interest soared when this was over. Ratings went up when he was the champion. It was always supposed to be a short-term thing, but it was going so well, and he and Lita had such great heel chemistry together. He thought instead of taking the title off him 3 weeks later at the Royal Rumble, they could easily drag this out until WrestleMania, and he could drop the belt back to Cena there. You know, it's like he said on the podcast, he knows they had their plans set for Mania, but it's not like these guys don't change their minds constantly. Plans change all the time. But Triple H was in the Mania main event that year, and, well, you know how that goes. That was one plan that was not going to change 3 weeks later, there he was, tapping out to John Cena at the Royal Rumble. I always thought that was a mistake. Also on the show was a bra and panties gauntlet match. First ever. There was another bra and panties gauntlet match. I sure as hell don't remember one. Maria, Candice Michelle, Tori Wilson, Victoria, Moolah, and Mae Young, who is still alive, by the way. Stories of her demise have been greatly exaggerated. They were all involved in the match. Ashley Massaro was out last and was in the ring for all of 30 seconds before de-panting Victoria for the win. And then she decided to strip for the fans anyway because, well, she's a hoe. 2 days later, on January 10th, 2006, at a SmackDown taping in Philadelphia, Batista surrendered the World Heavyweight title as a result of a torn tricep. And that's what I'm most interested in with Batista coming back now at, you know, what is he now, 45 years old or something like that? He tore a lot of muscles back in the day. I think there was another time where he was at a SmackDown taping, and I think Kane and Undertaker picked him up for like a double choke slam, and he tore something in his back. I mean, this guy became very injury prone for a period there, you know, many years ago, and now he's much older. What's he going to look like physically when he comes back on the 20th? And how's his body going to hold up? He wins that Royal Rumble. I'd be holding my breath if I'm WWE that he makes it to Mania healthy. So, anyway, here with the title vacant, they held a 20-man battle royal that same night to crown a new world champion, won by Raw superstar Kurt Angle. So, Kurt Angle from Raw wins the SmackDown battle royal to become the world champ. Angle would defend the title against Mark Henry in an awful main event at the Royal Rumble. They actually ended the pay-per-view with that match just so Undertaker could make his big return and they can do some magic tricks with the ring. The one good thing is that it led to an Undertaker-Kurt Angle match at No Way Out the following month, which was an awesome match, the complete opposite of Angle-Henry. And I would say that it should have been Undertaker-Kurt Angle at WrestleMania that year. That match gets praise, but not enough praise. And I feel like if it happened at WrestleMania 22 instead, people would remember it as an all-time classic, whereas now, you know, yeah, some people call it a classic, but I still feel it gets forgotten about because it was on a B show, and that's a match that should have been on an A show. I would have preferred Undertaker Angle over Undertaker Henry at WrestleMania that year, without question. And then Kurt got wasted on that show in a triple threat match with Orton and Mysterio. They gave those guys 8 minutes for a triple threat match for the world title. 8 minutes. They had their time cut. It's a waste of Kurt Angle. 7 years ago this week, on January 7th, 2007, WWE's New Year's Revolution pay-per-view in Kansas City featured a tag team match pitting Triple H and Shawn Michaels against Randy Orton and Edge as Team Rated RKO, which I thought was a shitty tag team name at the time, and I still think it's a shitty name. This was the match where Triple H tore his other quad while giving a spinebuster to Randy Orton. And much as he did after the first quad tear in 01, he continued the match, so I'm sure that had to suck. 2 years ago this week, on January 9, 2012, after weeks of teasing his return as this violent monster, it was on this episode of Monday Night Raw that we saw the debut of the Funkasaurus. Hailed from Planet Funk, Brodus Clay came out as the dancing fool with Cameron and Naomi. For the first time, he beat Curt Hawkins, who, if I remember, was carrying a pimp cane at the time and had no idea what to make of all this. I enjoyed the character. I thought they could make it work if they did a deal where it was all fun and games until someone decked him or started getting some offense on him, and then he would morph into this raging beast that we all thought we were going to get when he first came back. You know, not unlike the whole Joseph Park Abyss thing. You know, where when Joe Park bleeds, all of a sudden he turns into this monster. It's kind of a similar deal, where when you start fighting back and Brodus gets pissed off, or you punch him in the face, it's like he turns into the Incredible Hulk. You know, and he goes ape on somebody. But they didn't do that. He was just the big, jolly, fat guy. And, you know, hey, he went as far as he could with it. He got almost 2 full years out of that gimmick. And now we'll see where they go with this new main event player gimmick. He cut that great promo on Main Event a few weeks ago that I'm sure nobody saw. I wonder if his new gimmick actually means that we'll only get to see him on Main Event from now on. That'd be kind of funny, actually, if the Main Event player gimmick really just means that he will wrestle on Main Event and we will never see him. And 1 year ago, on January 9, 2013, Big E Langston defeated Seth Rollins in a no-DQ match to become the new NXT champion. There have only been three NXT champions since that belt was debuted. Seth Rollins, Big E Langston, and the reigning champion Bo Dallas, who has held the title longer than either of those first two men. Dallas is now on day 234. As the NXT champion. May 23rd last year is when he won that belt. I have a feeling that reign is coming to an end on the 27th against Adrian Neville. It's just my gut. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for me for the mailbag or any other reason, you can always reach me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter @solemonster. I live blog and tweet during Raw every single Monday night and every pay-per-view. So please follow me on there. We just passed 4,000 followers. Facebook, we're all over there as well. Send a friend request. I have a profile page under The Solemonster. We have a fan page that you can like, and we have a private discussion group. You have to apply for membership. I will approve you. A lot of you guys joined this past week. If you're not part of our community there, please log on. And we have a YouTube channel as well. If you type in The Solemonster, all one word, that's my username. We have the Sound Off Extra Bonus shorter episodes that go up every now and then. If you know, it could be a review of a show, it could be a review of a book, a wrestling DVD. So subscribe to the channel. Whenever a new video goes up, you will be notified, and you can watch those Sound Off extras on that channel. And don't forget, you can still vote in the Stitcher Awards. If you are listening to this podcast earlier in the week on Sunday or Monday, voting ends on the 13th, January 13th. So you can go on stitcher.promotw.com. Cast your vote for The Solemonster Sounds Off under the category of Best Sports Commentary. Thank you in advance for all your votes and your support. You guys have been awesome. And before we leave you here, I have a little bit of breaking news. There was a press release that was just put out for a new AAA TV show that is coming here to the United States. This has been rumored for a long time. And I think the deal was made a long time ago, and they only first now announced it. There was some television convention, I guess, that's going on. So I'm just reading what I see here. Mark Burnett of Survivor fame. He's the producer for, I think Survivor is still on the air. It's like the longest-running reality show on network television. Not cable. I know Road Rules and Real World and all that go back further on MTV, but Mark Burnett will be bringing Lucha Libre Promotion AAA to the United States with a regular weekly series on the El Rey Network, which is a new English-language cable entity that launched last month focusing on Hispanic pop culture. So I don't know how many homes El Rey is in right now. They're a startup network, but AAA is coming to the U.S. on El Rey, apparently with English commentary, which is very interesting because there have been rumors that maybe somebody like Jim Ross might be pitched by the AAA folks to possibly do commentary for them. I don't know if part of his release from WWE includes a non-compete. I would imagine there's probably something like that that will expire at some point. Maybe he can go do some work for AAA. If I'm AAA, I definitely make a play for Jim Ross to do my English language commentary. I think it goes without saying. Who wouldn't want Jim Ross to do commentary for them? So that's going to be another interesting story to follow here as we go along. Beyond all the WWE Network stuff and the future of TNA, all of a sudden Lucha Libre may finally gain a foothold in this country. I still feel like if it was going to be successful, it would have been already. I don't know that the audience is there, but you know they're going to get a shot. So we'll see where this story goes as the weeks progress. So I wanted to break that little bit of news here on the Sound Off. That's going to do it for this week. I will be back next weekend with episode 310 of the Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next week. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Solemonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
You don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's name. I gotta get rid of this bastard. I gotta get this club. This club sucks.
Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Solemonster Sounds Off.